Welcome into another edition of the Dan and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. Dan is on the line, as is the legend, Brian Snow. Guys, for the middle of August, I don't know that you could have a more eventful week for a college basketball team than what Xavier just had, as they wrapped up their three games in Spain and landed a commitment from one of their priority targets in Colby Jones, and that's where we'll start with this podcast. Snow, just sort of start us off with Colby. Tell us sort of what you saw from him while evaluating him, what he did this spring and summer to sort of move up in the rankings and everything, and what type of player Xavier's getting.
Yeah, they're getting a very versatile 6'6" athlete who's tough and can do a little bit of everything that isn't shoot the ball from three. Now, I know I was asked on the board, like, can he shoot? Can he not shoot from three? Or, is his form broken? He literally does not do it. So it's tough to really answer that question. But my hunch is if he could shoot, he would shoot. However, he doesn't shoot, so I'm guessing that he can't. Typically, that's the way this thing works. But he's a really good passer. He's 6'6". He's tough. He's one of the best defenders in the class, one of the most versatile offensive and defensive players. He plays the one. He can play the one through the four. Xavier's going to use him in a whole variety of roles. I know everyone loves a comparison game, and I really don't do that. But if you're looking for kind of a rough skill set, he's kind of a less athletic, higher IQ Najee Marshall type. They're different, but in terms of that's kind of the role I see him as, where he doesn't necessarily have a position. And he's not a refined shooter, and I know people are going to trot out Najee's shooting numbers in Spain. People, relax.
Snow, you sort of mentioned the player comparisons there. I think Najee makes sense. What do you think about a mixture of Najee Marshall and Josh Hart, kind of combining the IQ and the way Hart plays a little bit more on the offensive end?
Yeah, I'm just hesitant to say Josh Hart, even though they're actually really similar in high school. Because out of nowhere, Josh Hart became a really good shooter.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm still not sure how the hell that happened. This is a true story about Josh Hart. He was on his official visit to Xavier. He was shooting free throws, and the coaches from the observation deck outside Travis's office were like literally laughing because he was missing so many free throws by so much. And then 6 months later, he turns into Steve Kerr. So I'm just hesitant to say Josh Hart because that's the Josh Hart people have seen is the really good shooting version. But in high school, he was a non-shooter.
Yeah.
So, but
the playmaking, the IQ,
very, very similar.
Yeah. And that's sort of what I was getting at there. I think the comparison makes sense. And the versatility here, you said, he can play one through four, and that's not like just a throwaway line. I mean, in AAU, he played point guard a lot for his team this summer, and he was good at it. I mean, he really sets up his teammates well and makes them better.
Yeah, the one thing he kind of does, and you'll notice this with the Xavier team, is they're not the best at getting the ball to the teammates on time and on target. They may make some flashy passes, as we've seen, but generally speaking, this team, they tend to be a little bit like one beat late on the pass, and then it's not right in the shooting pocket. That's one thing Colby does a really good job of is, I guess they call it ball placement on the passes. He'll get it to you when you want it, get it to you in your shooting pocket. And that makes a really big difference for the shooter. And you tend to see there's a stark shooting percentage differential when the ball is delivered in the shooting pocket versus when it's not.
Snow, it seems like you made the comparison to Najee Marshall, and it seems like one thing that's similar between the two of them is that both of those guys kind of exploded during this summer in their respective careers of AAU ball or grassroots ball. Can you talk a little bit about what he showed this summer and the leap he made?
Yeah, honest to God, I didn't know who he was coming into April. And I went to an event down in Arkansas, and I happened to see him, and I thought he was good. I didn't think he was great, but I thought he was good. And then, Xavier offered him the next weekend at the first live evaluation period weekend, and I thought they were kind of crazy. And then, Rick and I saw him either at the end of April, beginning of May, I can't remember when it was when the EYBL came to Indianapolis. And I know we were both really impressed. I was like, whoa, this kid's a lot better than I thought.
Yeah, I remember you saying something. I mean, in the way you do, exaggerating a bit or something, but you said something like, Xavier's staff thinks this guy's a five-star or something, like to me, and you kind of like laughed about it. Then we watched him, we're like, hey, he's pretty damn good.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, at Peach Jam, he averaged roughly 20 points and 10 rebounds. Now, you know, you always have to take just raw counting stats with a grain of salt. It's more about how you get it. You know, not everything you do is a college bucket or a college rebound. And, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, he had a really good summer and he showed a lot of, you know, he just kind of, there's a reason he went from offers from Yale to offers from Stanford, Xavier, Georgia, Auburn, Alabama, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it wasn't because he played poorly. So, yeah, I mean, he exploded onto the scene. And give a lot of credit to Ben Johnson, did a tremendous job evaluating him early and really prioritized him and found the right ways to make this work. And let's be honest, Xavier doesn't beat Stanford very often for recruits, let alone for a recruit from Birmingham, Alabama. So here we are.
Yeah, you add him to a class with Dwan Odom and C.J. Wilcher, and I think you know, with Wilcher, especially on the wing, Wilcher is a guy who can really shoot it, but is going to struggle defensively, even if he gets better, even if he gets more athletic. That's just not going to be a strength of his. So, I mean, I think it makes sense to kind of pair these two together. They sort of complement each other's strengths and weaknesses well. But, Brian, just from an overall perspective, what are you thinking in terms of how this class kind of grades out and where it ranks compared to previous good Xavier classes?
It'll be up there. I don't see, you know, the Paul Scruggs Najee class. I still think from a recruiting perspective, from a rankings perspective, will be, you've got two studs at the top of that class. Now you have the Sumner Blewett McCura class was interesting. Blewett was the obvious stud. And then, you know, McCura and Sumner were kind of borderline top 100 kids. Now, that class probably turned out the best in Xavier history. I don't know that it would rank the highest at the time.
See, I think it would.
How much better Sumner got.
But McKinley London was also 72nd.
I mean, this class is going to be up there. And it's going to be a top 15 to 20 class nationally with probably only four guys, which is a really impressive thing.
So do you think the Scruggs and Najee Marshall and Elias Harden and Jared Ritter class is the best at Xavier, or would it be the 2014 class?
I think the 2014. Yeah, I'm talking myself in circles. I realize that.
See, I go 2014 because McKinley London, if we're factoring where they were at prospects at the time, McKinley London was also 72nd, is where you guys had him in the scout rankings at the time. So you had all those top 100 guys. I think Sumner was maybe just outside, or maybe McCura was just outside, but they were all basically top 100, and you had three of them turned out to be studs too.
Yeah, I mean, probably now that I think about it, I think 14 will be better from a rankings perspective, but this class will be right up there. And also, there, you know, as good as DeJuan is, like, he's not Trayvon.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, Trayvon was maybe the most safest, good English, Brian. One of the highest floor, safest bets to be a really good college player that I've ever seen. And DeJuan, you can at least imagine a scenario in which DeJuan Odom is not that. There was really no scenario in which Trayvon Blewett wasn't a 1,500-point scorer in college. And I don't see that guy in this class.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Looking forward, sort of what's left in this 2020 class, obviously the focus now is filling that forward spot. They're looking for a talented forward, hopefully a guy that can stretch the floor a little bit or at least score it. Seems like two of the top guys, and we've talked a lot about this on the message board, is Jalen Bridges and Ben Carlson are kind of the main priorities right now. They both have visits scheduled within the next few weeks, which you posted on the board. Brian, what are you kind of looking for out of these two in terms of how this plays out? Is there something to watch or a certain team that you think could screw all this up or change things? Or what's your eye kind of on?
My eye's just on, you know, Ben Carlson, really, because he's such a analytical type kid. He's a process guy. Can Xavier really show him that he fits not only on the court but off the court? I think, you know, his first official visit was more about exposure to Xavier basketball. You know, he got to see a game, which was a really good atmosphere. He got to experience, you know, kind of the pageantry, so to speak. This official visit, it's going to be more about getting to know the guys, you know, getting to know the coaches a little bit more, things like that. So, Ben, it's not just about basketball. It's about fit. And I think he needs to see that, you know, if he does or doesn't fit, you know, just personality wise. So I think that's kind of the interesting thing to really track and monitor.
Do you think say they get one of these forwards coming up here soon and they get that fourth guy in this class, what is the likelihood that they might add a fifth incoming freshman to the 2020 class?
Generally speaking, I'm going to say low. Hi, Dan's children.
And that's a cat, sorry.
The cat skin? That's the
that's
cat?
That's a cat.
That is a human.
That's mind-blowing.
That is a human.
Dan, are you sure your wife doesn't store kids in your basement somewhere?
This is a very old, very senile, possibly blind cat, and every night I think he gets lost and he starts yowling like that. It's kind of sad.
That is haunting.
Just imagine getting woken up by it at 4:30 every morning.
Oh, no.
That sounds awful. I'm not going to imagine that, actually.
It sort of plays into your whole ghost thing on Skinner's podcast. Maybe I should just record the cat.
You'd get
back to the game. Generally speaking, I don't think they'll take a fifth kid, and here's why. You know, certainly the staff is under the impression either Paul Scruggs or Najee Marshall is going to leave after the year. And at this point in time, I think the working assumption is both of them will. So basically, outside of Jason Carter and the frequently message board asked about Dontarius James, it would be all freshmen and sophomores on the roster. And if you have five in one class and five in another class, that's ridiculously young. So I think they would want to only go four in this class and then try to grad transfer it up and just try to get a little bit older.
Yeah, I think that makes sense too. There are a couple of other names should they maybe miss on the forward targets or they decide to eventually add a fifth one for some reason. There are a couple other names that we've talked about on the message board. I don't think it's worth really getting into those into detail right now.
I wanted to ask Snow a question because you posted something about Colby Jones's recruitment that kind of echoes something you and Rick have talked about a lot over the last, especially with the 2020 class, but I think we saw it a little bit with 2019, which was about this coaching staff and the level of organization they have, but even more so than that, the team approach they have to recruiting, where maybe in the past particular assistants had guys that were their guys, and it was up to the head coach to pick between them, whereas this staff seems to recruit everybody sort of en masse. And so I guess, Brian and Rick, my question for you is this a culture that Travis specifically wanted to build when he got the job and started putting his staff together, or did this develop organically just because of the personalities and just the way things have developed with these four guys working together over the last 18 months?
No, I think it was absolutely a focus from day one of one thing Travis wanted. And I think part of it is, you know, Travis has experienced it, you know, maybe at the beginning of his assistant career, he would really push his guys. And then, you know, he's worked with other guys that really push their guys. I think he saw, you know, John Gross and Sean Miller, they were really competitive with each other as assistants in terms of who they were recruiting, and would their guy be the top guy or would the other guy's guy be the top guy. And I think seeing all that, Travis said, like, that's kind of stupid. You know, I really want to establish this culture of we're recruiting together. Now, obviously, there's going to be a primary recruiter, but, you know, like, we all look good if we land good kids. And that's something he really instilled from day one, I would say, with this staff is, you know, we're not going to have this bickering where, you know, one guy gets all the credit and, you know, he's the only one who talks to a kid like, no, we're going to do a team approach. And there's a main recruiter because you have to have that, but it's going to be a team approach. Everybody's going to know everybody's kids, and we're going to work together to build the best roster we can, not just get, you know, one guy trying to be the recruiter of the year in the country on 24/7 Sports. And it has paid dividends in a big way.
Well, not only that, but doesn't it also provide something of insurance, given that all three of Xavier's assistants during last summer were courted for head coaching jobs, and in the case of Jonas Hayes, a potentially higher paying assistant job. Doesn't it also give you a little bit of insurance if you lose an assistant, that a guy that may have been his main target isn't necessarily off your board?
Yeah, I mean, there is something to do with that, but I don't think that really played too much into it. I think it was more about like just focusing on the best way to build a roster and to develop staff cohesion so that everyone's on the same page and there isn't this like infighting and bickering over whose guy is whose and I'm a push my guy, yada yada.
Yep. Right, and I think this Colby Jones situation is a perfect example, because you talked about it, Brian, in your post. Like, Dante Jackson was the quote unquote lead recruiter, although, as we said, that's kind of a misnomer for Niels Lane, and it gets him to the point where basically they probably could have pressed for a commitment, but the staff comes together and decides, you know what, we want Colby Jones, we think he should be our number one priority. And you know, it would be perfectly natural if you're Dante to feel just human nature, you would feel disappointed because of the work you put in. But everybody pulls together and they get the guy that as a group they decided should be the number one target. So I think that just demonstrates how selfless these guys are being in terms of just trying to put together the roster that they as a consensus feel is best for the program.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't, I know people think that should be common. It's not common. It really isn't.
Yeah, I think that it's a common philosophy. Everyone wants to do it. I mean, I've heard other staff say that's what we're doing and how we're doing things. The issue is you need everyone pulling in the same direction to do it. As soon as one guy isn't following up and calling on the guy you asked him to call on, or does try to say, well, yeah, I know everyone thinks this is the guy, but I want my guy in here first, so he kind of backdoors him, well, then everyone's out for themselves. It screws it all up. So everyone has to genuinely be on board with this, and I think the one thing it does, another thing that it does provide, in addition to what you guys were just talking about, and Mario mentioned this when we did the podcast, is that it really helps them if everyone has talked to the kid and gained a real relationship and understanding of what the kid's about before he arrives on like an official visit, because you're all going to be spending time with him and taking him around and talking to his family. And, you know, in the case of a kid like Colby, who is really smart and business and things like that. And, you know, he mentioned Fortune 500 companies and being in Cincinnati in the commitment article with Brian, things like that. When you have a kid who has specific wants and interests, having the entire staff on the same page and really understanding that, I think, is key. And that's sort of what this working together as a team gives you.
Yeah, and there's a lot to that. And it's just interesting how they've been able to do it. And no one's complained about it, you know, not even like under their breath, like, damn, you know, I got railroaded on this one, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's kind of, and I think it's because the staff genuinely likes each other too. That helps. They all get along really well. But to have everybody pulling on the same direction, it's not easy to accomplish. But when you do, it really makes everyone's life a lot easier.
Yeah, and by the way, the other part of that is it's just a ton of work. I mean, because you can't just be calling your kids. You have to call everybody's kids. And so it does create a heavier workload and a ton of organization, which they've done a really good job of. Of course, the post that Dan is referencing that Brian posted earlier today is on the musketeerreport.com premium message board. Some good stuff in there about the background of recruiting Colby and how this staff is working together. You know, we sort of talked about the 2020 class, but Brian, you got to think now that this class is sort of set and they know what they're looking at and they kind of have their primary focus to finish off the class, they've got to be putting a lot of effort into 2021 now and sort of looking forward. Is there any, I mean, it's probably too early to really know exactly what the biggest priority is going to be in terms of position, just because you don't know exactly who's going to pan out, who's going to leave, things of that nature. But is there anything that stands out to you right now as what something they're going to be looking for, whether that's position or skill set or type of kid?
I think they're going to try to get one shooter type in every class. Maybe that's a Luke Goody from Indiana, if they can get him, obviously. I think they might like a combo guard who's more of a scorer. And then I think they might look to another big guy. That would be my guess right now. But, again, it's so early. And the one help that they have is I think they know for sure Zach Fremantle and Deontay Miles are going to be able to play at the high major level. I think they figured that out. I think they like what they have in Kiki Tandy and Damir Bishop. So, you know, I think they kind of have a little bit of a feel, whereas a lot of times you wouldn't have that feel this early, so they can kind of focus. But I think what you're going to do, what you're going to see is they're going to go hard after maybe a few guys that they quote-unquote shouldn't get, whether that's a Malachi Branham, whether that's a Trey Kaufman, something like that. And then, you know, keep focusing on their bread and butter, which is the 50 to 125 ranked type guys, where you just continually build good player after good player, depth after depth. And I think, you know, they're not going to get carried away trying to fix something that isn't broken.
All right, Dan, anything else on the recruiting front, whether it be the 2020 class or beyond?
When do you guys think that we'll know whether it will be Carlson or Bridges, or if Xavier doesn't get either one, what do you think they'll do in that situation?
Then I think what you might see them do is try to go after a big guy and then focus on a transfer type at the four position. Because they seem to be all in on those two guys, and there's no guarantee they're getting either of them, but they like where they stand on both. And when I say those two guys, I mean Carlson and Bridges. So, you know, and that's kind of the one area they just haven't been able to build a lot of depth in terms of guys they like, is at that four position. But they have those two. They really like them. So, you know, everyone will see if they're able to lock it down. And I would imagine it wouldn't be too long. I mean, Ben Carlson, you know, he's already visited Xavier and Purdue officially. He's planning, as a junior, he's planning to do that again. He has been to Wisconsin enough where I don't think he plans to visit again. And then, you know, he took a senior year official visit out to Stanford, so he can't go back out there. I don't know that, you know, you get past the middle of September, I think he's going to know where he wants to go. So, you know, there's that one. And then Jalen Bridges, you know, he's got some September visits set. He's got an October visit set to Ohio State. But Ohio State has one scholarship to give, and they set a visit in October. Let's be honest, what are the odds that actually happens?
Mm-hmm.
So that could be a September type thing as well.
It is. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. The one thing I don't hate the idea of is if, you know, if maybe you don't get one of these forwards, or even if, you know, it's just sort of playing out. The one guy we haven't really talked about here that does seem to potentially still be in the mix is Gabe Madsen, another wing, a pretty good shooter, better shooter than Colby Jones, obviously. But with a guy like Colby Jones, who is so big and versatile and athletic, I don't hate the idea of just adding another wing in the mix and saying, we've got plenty of versatility here to where we can play multiple, all three of these guys at the same time, with, if you're talking about Wilcher, Madsen, and Jones. So I wouldn't mind seeing them think about going small in the future, especially since you still have Jason Carter for one more year. But I also understand, like, in the idea of building the ideal basketball team, you'd probably want a little bit more size at the forward spot.
Yeah, and I think we'll see. You know, Gabe Madsen's supposed to visit here in a couple of weeks. We'll see what happens there. My hunch is that visit doesn't happen, but I think the staff still has to figure that out.
All right, I think that probably does it for the recruiting conversation. The next thing on the list is the three games the Musketeers played in Spain over the course of the last week. A little bit of a mess. They won all three games handily. I think they got much more out of the 10 practices before they left than they did these games while they were over there. But it did at least allow us the chance to see sort of how some of these younger guys, especially in the other newcomers, Jason Carter and Bryce Moore, did in actual game scenarios, which was nice. We'll just start here. What was kind of your guys' main takeaways or the first things that come to your head when you think about the three-game stretch, and whether it was the games you watched or what it says in the box score?
I was just going to say, I think we have to start with Flow Sports and their announcing crew, because it's caused a lot of controversy. Rick Flo-Ring.
I mean,
Syntus Center.
Xavier at the Syntus Center.
So, as Mario said on the podcast, this flow thing was sort of the, I guess, the best option that they came up with to stream these games, which is fine.
I find flow, it hard to believe.
Yeah, flow has sort of a checkered history with FC Cincinnati and DC United and some of the other properties they have. There's not really too many people who have been happy with the product they put out. And I guess they record their commentary in some windowless room and Texas or something like that. So one of the guys did sound like you, Rick.
I really do not think he does.
The tape.
Do you want to play it right now? I do not think he does.
Wait, yeah, go ahead and play the tape. Let's go to the tape.
And they felt they were really getting it together at the end of last season. You see the beautiful dump off there. Acrobatic look to Jones, who rocked the rim.
Tyreek Jones, the senior out of Bloomfield, Connecticut, bringing the rim rocker. Seeing the power inside from the 6'9 senior.
Tyreek Jones, the 6'9 senior from Bloomfield, Connecticut, with the rim rocker. That's not me. That's not me.
I don't know, man.
Him either.
What?
Well, Rick is going to paste it in, Snow. We weren't actually going to listen to it.
Did you not hear it?
No.
Oh, I was just playing it. We just
had a really awkward silence. I was figuring you had lost it. We're trying to find it to play it.
I thought it played.
And
never mind. It's playing through my headphones. I thought it was playing in the speaker. We'll just skip that part.
Okay, don't go to the tape.
Don't go to the tape.
We'll just assume that the guy sounded like you. So as Snow and I were laughing about before we started recording, I guess the best part of the three games in Spain is that there wasn't an international incident. Not for lack of trying. But
yeah, for the record, that is always goal number one. You don't want a UCLA situation where you're in a
Georgetown in China.
Guys are chasing each other with chairs. So that's always goal one. It's no international incident. And while we can't confirm that, it seems that everyone was able to return to America today.
Although I think I saw on Twitter they were stuck in Washington, D.C., so I don't know if they ever got home. But,
get them to build a little toughness.
So did you guys have any takeaways about the actual games, or...?
I don't really know what you were supposed to learn from playing the YMCA All-Stars, a bunch of guys with beer guts and mustaches, and by the third game who were just cheap-shotting people and trying to hit them with folding chairs off the court. But, I mean, what I've heard from everybody is basically what you mentioned earlier, Rick, was the play of Zach Fremantle and Deontay Miles. Both of them looked like they were ready to contribute at a high major level. They both flashed a lot of skill and a lot of athleticism, and they both looked a little bit closer to not a finished product, but but usable pieces than maybe we thought they would be at this early stage.
For me, I would say the first thing is Damir Bishop right now today on August 15th is better than Elias Harden, period. Not going to be better, not could be better. Is better.
So Xavier will win the Big East this year?
I don't recall saying that.
Well, Elias Harden would have put them over the top if Steele would have played him more last year.
That's true. That is true.
Do you not
I keep
the
forgetting
board?
That Elias's 3 points a game was key to massive victories all over the place last year. That's one thing I took away. Just basically that the young guys are ready. Kiki Tandy can play. Zach Fremantle can really play. Deontay Miles is going to be able to play. I don't know if he can play this year, but he's going to be able to. And then, you know, Bryce Moore adds a real dimension with how hard he plays defensively. And he didn't make shots in Spain, but he's going to make shots. And then, this team didn't run one set play in Spain. Not one. And I think at times Steele kind of put the reins on them when they knew they could have gotten to the rim every possession, especially in the first game. But what are you going to get after? What are you going to get out of that with Q just driving past some guy like me? So I think he put the reins on. And Jason Carter is a high major player, period, end of story. I think those are kind of the biggest takeaways.
Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to mention, too, about those games that I thought was fantastic was that the ball that they were using, like it had stuff written on it in magic marker. Like it was the ball Brian brought to basketball practice that had like snow written on it so he would remember to take it home with him. I thought that was pretty great.
Well, as my JV baseball coach told me at Holy Cross, it's not whether you win or lose, it's how much equipment you come home with after the game. You don't want to lose basketballs, Dan. They're expensive. So you make sure you write your name on there in magic marker. I think that makes a lot of sense. That's a prudent decision by the Spaniards. Xavier does that, but they just get them imprinted from Nike before they come with a big X on them. So I don't think that's
unusual. It's embroidered.
Yeah. I think both you guys hit it with the big guys. Fremantle really stood out. He looks like he's going to be a stud. He's just so tough. And that really stood out to me maybe in the second or third practice when he and Tyreek Jones were both chasing down a loose ball, and he wasn't going to get to it, so he just elbowed Tyreek in the face. I thought that was a bold decision, and at that moment I knew he's like, that dude's tough. Like he does not like losing.
That is not what I would have done, but
no, me neither. But he thinks a little bit differently. I mean, I can't wait to see the Arrival series that they're about to show with the freshmen, because hearing his mom talk about him playing basketball in Rucker is just going to be fantastic. I can already tell.
It was exactly what I thought it would be.
Exactly. That you knew that was his mom immediately as soon as she started talking. It's like, yep, that's got to be Zach's mom. Fantastic. So, yeah, I think I think that stood out. The young guys, the one thing I kind of thought is going to be interesting is the team, they shot really well in the second game. But the first and third game, they didn't shoot well from the outside. And you kind of got the same group of guys. So unless like Najee Marshall is just going to shoot much better from three-point range this year, or maybe Quentin Gooden, is the starters probably aren't going to shoot a ton better from the perimeter, which means you're going to need some three-point shooting from the young guys. So their role is going to be to come in and jack up some threes, but man, are these guys quick to do it. I mean, there's a lot of possessions where it's one pass to the wing and a freshman is hoisting up a three, or Bryce Moore is hoisting up a three. I'm wondering sometimes how the ball – I think there are going to be a few games this year where this team just completely shoots themselves out of a game, where they everyone's a little bit cold and they're just jacking bad shots. So I'm interested to see how they sort of rein that in and get the ball movement working, especially when you start making those rotations when actual games are happening and we're not playing the Spanish All-Stars and all the backups are getting 25 minutes a game.
You know, there is a tendency among fans, which we have – noted before, that especially in preseason, you kind of focus on the guys who are maybe marginal, like as Brian said, a lot of questions about Dontarius James, who probably won't play a whole lot this year. And so people are always curious about the freshmen as well. I guess, Rick, from the 10 pre-Spain practices and the games, what did you see from the sort of big four? Any developments there? Anything of note that you saw different about them now than maybe in March?
Yeah, well, I think Najee Marshall looked fantastic both in the practices and in the games in Spain. His handle, people seem to think it was a problem last year. I didn't really see that. I've always liked his handle. It's one of the things I liked about him in high school. But he did turn the ball over a little bit too much last year, which I didn't necessarily think was his handle. But he looks like he's even tightened that up. He made some really, really impressive moves with change of direction while he was in Spain. He also shot the ball really well in the first two games and then was 1-for-6 from three in that third game while he's over in Spain. But just his overall attitude and mentality, the way he's approaching it, the way he's interacting with his teammates, you can't say enough good things about how he's carried himself this past 3 weeks or whatever it's been. Paul Scruggs, I know people were asking me about him because he didn't score hardly at all over there. He only took two shots in 15 minutes in the first game and didn't score. And then he had 4 points in the nine points in the second game and 4 points in the third game. So he just didn't break double digits at any point, but he was doing a lot of driving. And Dan sort of, or Brian, one of you two mentioned that it felt like Steele almost pulled the reins back on the guys from getting to the rim every time. That definitely seemed to be the case with Scruggs, as he would get into the lane and then drop it off to Freeman or Lord Jones or someone for an easy two. So I don't think there was like any issue with Paul Scruggs in there or that he played poorly. I thought he looked pretty good, actually. And then Gooden, I think Quentin Gooden looks locked in. I mean, he still probably shot a few too many threes while they were in Spain, but he was 2 for 6 in the second game and 2 for 4 from deep in the third game. So it's not like he shot poorly. I think all of those guys, and then Tyreek Jones, I didn't mention him, but he's been fantastic the whole way through. I mean, just exactly what you'd expect. He was really consistent over in Spain in terms of finishing. He's a monster on the glass. I think all four of those guys look really, really good.
Yeah, you know, with Tyreek, it's interesting. As he keeps losing weight, I'm convinced he's actually getting shorter as well. Like, when he came in, I thought he was close to 6'8". Now I'm like, that dude's 6'5".
I couldn't agree more. Like, when he puts it in the braids, his hair, he looks really short.
He looks 6'5". It's crazy. But as he gets shorter, he's becoming a better rebounder. It's really an odd thing. I don't really understand what's going on there. But this trip wasn't about those four guys. For one, they're not really going to care. Let's be honest. They're just not going to care that much. Two, they know what the system is, and they know they're not running the system. And then three, you know, it's just not – their goal was don't get hurt. And they accomplished that goal to the best of our knowledge outside of Paul and Tyreek puking and getting thrown out of games and things of that nature. But, you know, in general, they accomplished their goals. I think if anyone has a worry about any of those four guys, let's be honest, that means things are going really, really well for Xavier.
Yeah, I think, you know, people brought up the turnovers, too, in addition to the three-point shooting. And
well, half of those were they stepped out of bounds.
Yeah, that was the one thing I was going to say. A lot of it's just like kind of the nature of sloppy overseas playing against an all-star team. That's kind of what, you know, people are throwing the ball all over the place. You get caught up in that a little bit. And then guys keep stepping on. Every time they threw the pass into the corner, someone was standing out of bounds. So I don't know if there was, like, I guess there's a different length in between the three-point line and out of bounds in college.
Rick, that's actually, I swear, I was talking to a coach last night. That's kind of one of the – he says that the court, as he put it, court geography on that corner three is really different now, because that 1 foot that the international distance was from the college, the old college distance, it stays that 1 foot on the sides. And typically these guys, the first thing they do when they catch it on the at the corner is you take a step back. And the moment you take that step back, you're out of bounds. And every college coach is kind of going through that right now, where a lot of their guys are turning it over in that scenario. And that's going to come with reps. I think people start to understand. I mean, you don't see it happen in the NBA very often, but it's happening in all the college games right now, as guys are just stepping out of bounds. And that's understandable, because they've never played with that distance before for the three-point line. And then also the ball is very different. And, you know, like Jason Carter, like, he dropped the ball 4 times. I don't think, like, Jason Carter's going to drop the ball 4 times during the regular season. And also, out there, they're playing in gyms without air conditioning. Sometimes you're just going to fall on your ass when that happens.
Yeah, and that – well, and you, the bigs dropping the ball or just losing it because it was sweaty or whatever else, that was a common problem, because Fremantle had a ton of turnovers. Carter had a ton of turnovers. Miles had a couple turnovers in the last game. So they that was a common problem. But the guards, the only game I thought where it was like sort of you would be concerned, it's like, what's going on here, was the second game when, you know, you had Scruggs turned it over 3 times, Gooden turned it over 3 times, Marshall turned it over 3 times. Then you had all the other guys turn it over kind of their normal amount as well. It was like, all right, that game, it got a little bit ridiculous. You'd like to see them tighten it up. But in general, no, I don't think turnovers were like a serious issue or anything.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, I think the whole foreign tour thing from a basketball perspective, both the games and the practices, are overrated. I'll be perfectly clear on that. I think the biggest thing you get is the team camaraderie and kind of guys that didn't think they'd like each other actually kind of liking each other. And that's typically, I think, the most important thing you get out of these events.
Yeah, a slight head start when you've got a bunch of new guys learning your system, and that's about it, like you said. Other than that, it's team camaraderie. One other somewhat interesting point where Travis Steele might have tipped his hand slightly. We'll see how much it actually happens in real games. We did see them pick up full court. A lot of times it was just one guy, whether it was Bryce Moore, Kiki Tandy, the point guard, picking up the other point guard full court. That's something they haven't really done in the past. And then a couple different times after a dead ball, they would come out and the entire team would be picking up full court in a press. Steele talked about it after the game. That's something he liked that look when they were using it. It helped them turn the pace up and get a few more possessions, which is something he's looking to do this year with all their depth. So I'm interested to see how much that becomes a real thing in actual gameplay.
Yeah, I think he's going to want it, especially when Bryce Moore's in the game with the way he can guard 94 feet.
Yeah.
Now, it's not even a press designed to – first of all, you know, I don't know if we should even call it a press. I guess it's a one-man press, which is what it is. But it's certainly not designed to get turnovers. It's designed to wear down the opposing guard. You know, when Miles Powell's dribbling the ball up the court, can you make his life miserable? You know, there's some value in that, even if he doesn't turn it over. And also, you know, what it does is it shortens the shot clock. So you have to play defense in the half court for less of a time, and the guys can run less stuff. So I think that's kind of the theory behind it. And I do think, especially when Bryce is in, you're going to see that Xavier do that. Will it be every possession like it was in Spain? Probably not. But I do think you'll see that a good amount of time.
Yeah, when Bryce came into the game and picked up full court like that, it changed sort of the intensity and energy of everybody on the defensive end. He kind of brings a little bit something different there. Now, I do think you saw his limitations a little bit in Spain too. People are really high on him and excited about what they're hearing, but you kind of saw, like, he's going to be a guy who defends his ass off and he'll shoot threes when he's open, or maybe even when he's not, but that's kind of what he does. There's not going to be a lot else there on the offensive end. He's not creating. He's not even really looking to score in other ways. It's pretty much, if he's on, he'll hit you a couple threes. If he's not, he might miss you a handful of threes as well, but I do think he's somewhat limited on the offensive end after seeing him in Spain.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's a 3-and-D guy from the shooting guard spot. I mean, just kind of what it is. There's definitely some limitations there offensively.
I think maybe the last sort of item on the list that we haven't talked about yet is the newest addition to the coaching staff. Travis Steele did fill Jeremy Groh's spot. Jeremy Groh was a special assistant to Travis Steele last year after previously being the director of operations. He is now an assistant at Furman, and they have hired Matthew Graves to become Travis Steele's special assistant to the head coach. Last year, I think this job, it entailed a lot of the administration and organization stuff that the job previously did, but it also had a little more emphasis on scouting and doing video work, looking at opponents ahead of time and preparing stuff for the coaches to do their scouting reports. And you sit, you know, right next to the head coach and offer a lot of input and suggestions during games. Snow, what's kind of your take on, one, the hiring of Matthew Graves, and two, what role he'll play on Travis Steele's staff?
Yeah, I think this is basically a straight basketball role. And then he'll assist in recruiting in the sense of maybe setting up the visits and, you know, organizing which hotel and things like that. But it's going to be a basketball role first and foremost, and involved in game planning, helping scouting, certainly advanced scouting. And then, you know, helping Travis, you know, just kind of being someone to bounce ideas off of. Because even though Jeremy was young, Jeremy was in the Xavier system 10 years, basically, 9 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also, he's one of Travis's best friends. So there was a significant amount of trust there. So replacing that isn't easy. And with Matthew, what you have is a guy, you know, he was the associate head coach on a team that went to back-to-back national title games. He was he didn't have a great head coaching record at South Alabama, but it wasn't awful. And he was there, I think, 4 years, maybe five. And he's in a role that's special assistant to the head coach. He's overqualified for that job, to be perfectly honest. So I think the fact that Xavier was able to get him in that role, it says a lot, and it can be seen as nothing but a positive.
Yeah, do you think the enticing part of taking a job like this is just because of the success that people in the Xavier system have had? I mean, in terms of becoming an assistant and then becoming a head coach, and you just are kind of always a hot name if you're in this program?
I think that's part of it. I also think, Matthew, he worked at Butler, but, you know, he never he worked at Butler for the 1 year that they were in the A-10, I believe, and then mostly when they were in the Horizon League. So, you know, obviously Butler's a tremendous program, and I want to make that very clear, but in his mind, he's kind of never worked at a high major program because he's never been in, you know, a program that has the financial support that Xavier does, that has the recruiting wherewithal that Xavier does. Because by the time Butler got, you know, to that level, he was at South Alabama. So he's been at Butler in the Horizon League, basically. He's been at South Alabama, and he's been at Evansville. So this gives him a chance to get some quote-unquote high major experience as well.
Is this another situation where potentially if one of the existing Xavier assistants leaves next year, he sets himself up to be a candidate for that role?
That's a to be determined. I know Travis never promised him that, and I know Matthew never wanted Travis to promise him that. The way Matthew views it is I have to prove myself to get into that role. I've been in Travis's chair. I know what I have to do to make myself seem like a viable assistant coach to him. So while nothing is guaranteed, you know, it does give him a chance on a day-in, day-out basis to prove to Travis, and I don't want to make it seem like he's auditioning because that's not his job, but to prove to Travis that if he does have an opening, that, hey, I'm the guy you should hire. And, you know, I think, you know, that's part of it, but there was no promises made, that's for sure.
Do you, I mean, it does seem pretty wild to think that, you know, if, because I believe the way that the timeline worked out, that Graves had left Butler for the South Alabama job right before Brad Stevens left for the Celtics. And you kind of wonder if Graves had still been on the staff, if he'd have been the next Butler coach when Stevens left. So it's kind of wild the way this is developed.
Yeah. Matthew actually took the South Alabama job. You know, it was silently, but he got the South Alabama job at the beginning of April, kind of right as Butler was getting to the NCAA tournament. And Brad left on July 4th. So it was about, what would that be, 3 months? So, yeah, he took the South Alabama job 3 months before Brad left. And as the associate head coach, I would have to expect he would have been named head coach of Butler.
I want to say Rick and I were sitting at Yard House when that news broke, and both of us were like, oh my, and Rick's phone started to smoke.
I was actually in the Cintas Center, and Chris Mack walks out of his office. He goes, you're never going to guess who the head coach of Butler is, or the head coach of the Celtics is. I'm like, I have no idea. He goes, Brad Stevens. I go, holy crap. I was just in his office yesterday. Actually, coincidentally enough, on the phone with a Boston Celtics scout who called me as I walked into Brad's office. He had to think like something was wired or something, but it was an interesting scenario. That's for sure.
All right. You guys have anything else here on anything we've talked about before we wrap this show up?
Zip them up.
Ditto.
You've been listening to another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only available on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan and the legend, Brian Snow, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.